I've always admired people who move in such trustable ways. Like they just know and trust what's happening in their bodies, in the moment, and can express it with such ease and humility. Like they're aware of every sensation and emotion that's happening in real time. And they use it to help them receive and respond so naturally. I think of someone who knows how to offer a really good hug just when you need it. Like full-bodied, deep, warm hug that just communicates the essence of care and love. Or when someone speaks up in a circle to share an important story or piece of advice. And they're doing it not just through their head or through their words, but they're communicating with something deep inside them. And when these bodies, these people are in a room, we wake up. We tend to pay attention. But many of us, and I include myself in this, especially Gen X and older, we've been taught to distrust our bodies, to distrust that part of ourselves that is so crucial to this wisdom. We've learned to ignore certain sensations that offer us important information. And I'm thinking of exhaustion, our anxiety, and sometimes our fear. Partially because we've needed to rise up against systems of oppression and stay on top of our game. It's like society has demanded that our bodies harden, armor up, to stay in the fight. And yet, if we're to embrace knowing with more of ourselves, as my teacher, Cynthia Bergeau, encourages us, the body can become a trustable friend. It took me decades to befriend the wisdom of my body, and honestly, it's a work in progress. But over the last 2 decades, I've slowly worked on this tension between my mind and the body, and slowly understanding and dissolving this unhelpful binary. And through that dissolution, I've come to appreciate that my body holds tremendous power and wisdom. So my first guest in season 3 of The Tension of Emergence helps us unpack the wisdom of the body by helping us understand the body is not an object, but an event. I've been following Prentice Hemphill for a few years, enlivened by the way they weave together the body's wisdom, political activism, and collective healing. Prentice is a writer, an embodiment facilitator, political organizer, and therapist. They are the founder and director of the Incredible Embodiment Institute and the Black Embodiment Initiative, and host of the acclaimed podcast, Finding Our Way. For the last 10 years, Prentice has practiced and taught somatics and social movement organizations and offered embodied practice during moments of social unrest and organizational upheaval. They have taught embodied leadership with Black Organizing for Leadership and Dignity and Generative Somatics, and served as the Healing Justice Director of Black Lives Matter Global Network from 2016 to 2019. Their work and writing have appeared in the New York Times, the Huffington Post, and are about to have their first book published, What It Takes to Heal, which is out on June 4th. So if you're listening to this live, go pre-order or grab it when it comes out. It's going to be amazing. Prentice teaches us how to trust our own bodies in order to widen our capacity to be with each other through the mess of leading our own lives. So with that, my friends, enjoy this amazing conversation with Prentice. So I was reflecting on this question and curiosity about your interest and passion for embodiment, and I wanted to start with what kind of cultural messages did you receive as a little kid about what was okay and what wasn't?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a layered question, and it's also one that I'm finding is more and more informed by raising a child. I have a 2.5-year-old, and so it's giving me a lot of opportunity to see how we relate to our bodies, how the social norms around us, how our families around us, community around us also shape our relationships to our bodies. So that's been really interesting. I think for me, the messages I received were, I mean, I think church was a big part of it. So I think there was some element both of how much life existed in our bodies, how much reverence came through our bodies. You know, Sundays for me at church were an opportunity to really see people let go, to shed, to shake, to cry, to praise. That was an understanding that I had about bodies. I thought, you know, bodies sort of went to work and did what they were supposed to do during the week. And on Sundays, something else got to come through. And then I think simultaneously, there's a story of shame that gets attached to our bodies, even through those same institutions, through church, you know, the sexuality as shameful, or, you know, any number of so-called sins are shameful. So there was this looming kind of shame that started to descend on my body. So I think it was both. I think it's always been both. My body as a place where I could experience the ecstatic or transcendent, and a place that had elements that I should feel shameful about or hide.
Yeah, that's for I just relating so much to relating to church. I grew up in the church too, but Roman Catholic, and that was not a place where you could cry or shake or the reverence, yes. But I'm listening to this interesting distinction that you're making around sort of the constricted body throughout the week and then this release on Sundays is a fascinating observation that you had as a kid, and then this piece around shame and the messages that you received around sexuality, which I can also really relate to, and particularly for trans women, those bodies is not okay to be embodied, expressive. And so, how did you start to navigate those dualities? You know, the reverence and the release that I'm hearing around bodily expression. And then as you grew up, this story of shame.
You know, it's an active thing. I mean, it's very binary in a way, or it seems opposing in a way. But I find, especially maybe in the Black church, and maybe in the Black church at that time that I was growing up, it felt like a very active conversation. And there was what I think is a very Black Southern, maybe even African way of being in our bodies. And then there was the will of the church. And there are ways that we were have always been sort of subversive in making sure that our bodies could be living even in those conditions. And then there's always the way the church has kind of come down. Now, I'm not saying, I think there's a lot of places that sort of naturally exist in church anyway, where we can, like you said, there's reverence even in the way that you practiced it. But it always felt like a very live negotiation between that shame and also that transcendence and that felt sense. So I would say it's remained a living conversation inside of me. I had that, but I also danced, and I grew up around people who danced. And so, in a way, even if I didn't language it as embodiment or any of the more technical terms that we use to talk about being present to our bodies, I danced. And I danced not only to, you know, do whatever dance moves were out, but I danced to express myself, to process grief, to process loss or transitions. I danced in those moments. And I think I probably come from a long line of people that danced in that way, maybe unbroken. So I also use dance in that way. And I always have. I mean, I danced this morning when I got up, to be honest, to find the relational part of me. I had to dance through that. So Yeah, that's just a part of where I come from, and a part that I try to keep alive, and I try to hold it as brilliant and not just something that we do for fun. I hold it as a technology that we've preserved over time that supports our growth and development and processing, and it's genius. Yeah, I think I missed the second part of your question about shame, but I'm happy to answer it if you
Oh,
restate it.
I'm like so loving that you danced this morning, and then I was really curious about what song you danced to. So,
Can tell you that.
yeah, tell me. I'm curious. What helped move you into relationality, like this invitation, a sacred entering into a remembrance to your relationality that dance helped you this morning?
Well, it's funny because I played pretty churchy songs this morning, which isn't necessarily the usual, but I played, what's her name? LaShawn Pace, a gospel singer from Pace family. I played Sounds of Blackness, Optimistic, Be Optimistic. It was kind of a churchy morning, surprisingly.
It's as I was driving to this to the podcast studio, Joni Mitchell came on
Oh.
a little clip from the Grammys, and at 80 she's singing Both Sides Now, and I
Oh, don't
so
do this to me.
as I'm driving to talk to you, I'm bawling in the car listening to Joni at 80 sing Both Sides Now, and it's like so that just reminds me of this, like both sides. It's a conversation. It's a conversation between shame and reverence, a sacred technology, and coming into the present moment. And then this movement,
Well, I just want to have a Joni interlude for a moment because I'm a gigantic Joni Mitchell fan and went to the Gorge over the summer to see Joni perform with Brandi Carlile. And I
No.
watched her on the Grammys last night. I watched her and I cried. I've loved Joni for how many years now? I mean, like 25 years I've loved Joni Mitchell. So
So this is your official
just want to say that.
invitation that you got to come to the homeland of Joni and cross that border,
That's true. That's true.
but you
Yeah.
got to do it not in snowstorm winter season.
I won't. I won't.
So this is your official invitation, and
Thank you.
I encourage you to come all the way to the past the north of 60 and to the light and night of the midnight sun and come check it out. Okay, so great. So
Lovely.
dancing. So is this, I'm just curious, like when did you first discover the freedom in your own body? And I'm curious how, like, if you have the earliest memory of when you felt fully free in your body and how that might have been a clue to this path of discovering that the body is a force of transformation.
I think the question for me is almost when did we lose it? You know, when did you lose it? Because raising a child, you know, yesterday I was watching her, she was drawing and just drawing. I mean, what we might think was chaotically, it was just all over the place and heavy marks. And she was listening to the sound of how she marked and she was moving things around and different elements of drawing. She was exploring different elements of what it meant to draw and make a mark on something, the sound, the movement of her own body. And yeah, I think in that I thought, when do we become unfree? And I think that's a really important question for me because I don't know that it's even something to discover. I think it's something that is, and then it's something that is obscured by training, by society, by inheritance from our family. I think it's something that over time gets reshaped. Now, we have to be shaped by our conditions because, you know, even as a parent, I have to communicate things that we don't do for our safety. We have to hold hands when we're by the street. So there's a watchfulness that I'm inviting her into when we come across something that's a little bit more dangerous. There's heightened vulnerability there. So I'm shaping her that way. And I intend to do that because I want her to be able to navigate the world. And I think there's a lot of shaping that we receive that is not related to our own lives, that is not attentive to our own sense of freedom, that recruits us actually into other people's agenda. I think there's so much shaping like that that actually doesn't prepare us to be in the world. And I think that's where we get confused. I think there's a lot of confusion that sits on top of people. There's a lot of past stories that sit on top of people that we're, I mean, you could say is living in the tissues in a way that's sort of living in our bodies and in our behaviors. And I think underneath that is freedom that just is there, but we are so far removed from it. And so we're lost in other stories that keep us disconnected from, I think, the freedom that already exists.
For you, what stories are those? What are the biggest ones that you're seeing at this time, in this moment? The stories that are not yours, not ours, however, our, I'm putting that in quotations because we are not all the same.
Yeah, I think the stories of hierarchy, and what I mean is the stories of who's worth more, who should be listened to, who's not to be listened to, who should be cared for, who's good, who's not good. I think a lot of us are trapped in those stories. A lot of people are trapped in a story that they're good, that they're the good ones or the good guys or innocent is something I always talk about. And I think that's a way of being trapped. But I think these stories of goodness, badness, if we feel sort of inherently unworthy, inherently bad, we get trapped in that story, disproving it or trying to prove it. This is one of the ways that history and the kind of historical ranking or taxonomy of human beings lives inside of each of us and has us each striving to escape this story or reinforce it so that we feel safe. I think we get trapped in those stories. I think around gender, in a lot of different ways, we get trapped into moving away from what is authentic to who we are, how we feel, what we know, acknowledging who supports us, being in touch, I guess, for better, lack of a better word, term, it with our own emotions. I think all of this is us being stuck in a story of who you should be and being unable to tolerate who you are. I think these are some of the ways, and of course, our own experiences of trauma or the traumas that our families carry. There are stories that persist in us that we are sometimes trying to respond to a story that we didn't even experience. But it's a fear that didn't get processed that is then shared with us or passed on to us in a lot of different ways. And I will just say, I think, you know, some of these stories of goodness or badness get you can extrapolate it to the degree that it's useful onto the way that our world is set up, the narratives countries have about who they are and who the other is, who's deserving of protection, who's not. It's the stories that trap us and keep us from actually being present with one another, being real, and being willing to or capable of changing. You can't change if you're actually stuck in a myth.
Yeah, it reminds me of just bringing in some good old Judith Butler, like the performativity of certain identities in order to fit in, belong, stay safe, avoid policing, all those different ways in which bodies in this hierarchy and it the cis hetero patriarchy of, set up by colonial modernity to just name all the things, but that there's real material impacts day to day. And what I'm hearing you say is that these stories of who's good, who's bad, who's in, who's out, from the self to community to culture to nation, this separates us, the illusion of separation. We're ultimately free, but this creates the illusion of separation. So how does the body, how does working with somatics help us start to break these binaries down?
Well, the body doesn't work in binaries, or let me say this differently. We are already working with the nuance in our bodies. And I think our ability to feel what is actually happening inside of each of us reveals a lot of nuance. What do I actually feel about this? I might feel a mix of things. I might feel a mix of excitement, repulsion, you know, doubt, fear, all these things. Multiple things are existing at once. And the more that I can hold and be with that and what's going on in my body, the more I can make room for nuance. And people are really scared of nuance in this moment, I think, because we're in so much reactivity. And we're incentivized to be in so much reactivity. And sometimes some moments require quick responses. That is true. And for a human to maintain a state of reactivity is going to diminish our ability to be with our own feeling, to be with nuance. And when we are not, and I think this is a point that people miss, when we can't hold nuance, we can't actually be precise. We end up becoming
Yes.
redundant, or we mimic, or we try to say the right thing. Again, it traps us in the right wrong. Nuance actually helps us be precise about what action we take next, because we can hold more considerations, can hold more of our position and relationship, and from that place be precise about what we do and how we move. But we're so, and I don't blame individual people when I say this, but I think what I'm witnessing is heightened reactivity and an inability for a lot of people to exit that state into feeling. And I see increasingly societies in a world that is capitalizing or commodifying that reactivity for its own use. And people are forgetting what it is like to not be in that state. And that's something that sort of worries me in this moment, because I think what we're looking for is found in feeling. It's found in the body in that way. So, you know, I think, and I will say somatics has been part of my own journey of transformation and healing. And I've, you know, I think that what we're talking about with somatics is bigger almost than the kind of practices that we're taught. So I kind of use the word embodiment even more. But even beyond that, I'm also talking about ritual and culture. What we do with each other, what we do with ourselves is somatics, it's embodiment, and it's culture. And I think that gives us a way back in. It's a portal back in to feeling. The practices that are most useful to you in whatever state are any practice, any movement. It can be a somatic practice, it can be a hug, it can be a dance, it can be sitting in a circle. But whatever portal it is that returns you to feeling, to nuance, to presence, that's the way for this time and for all time.
Oh, I could take so many different threads, but what I so appreciate about what you just said was that the nuance, being able to hold multiple feelings at the same time, rather than just outrage, for example, you know, that comes in terms of the inflammation that's happening at this time, or anger or resentment. Being able to hold more of it allows a precision of what to do. And that to me is the bridge between the inner world of our own experience that no one else can see but us to feel, you know, to social, right social action, right next move. Because what I notice is this kind of flattening. What we're doing is we flatten. We judge and then flatten and collapse multiple experiences into one in order to make a quick post, for example, on social media, which is then co-opted by the algorithm, which is co-opting our egos in terms of likes. And it's just such a fascinating system that I agree with you is taking us and keeping us in this degree of social inflammation that creates a buffer from our deep internal true experience.
And that's where I think our power really lies, is in there. And, you know, if I can take right action according to who I am, where I'm positioned, my all of that, if I can figure out, if I can feel, yes, my rage, my love, my helplessness, my fear, all of these things, it can sort of point me in the direction of what support do I need? What step do I want to take? Who do I want to connect with? It gives you more clarity on that. And yeah, I think instead we end up doing again what we think we're supposed to do. And We sort of miss the mark, I think, of creating or finding maybe roads or paths that are hard to see or are we're uniquely positioned to see. I think we lose a lot of our creativity and our options and our power, when we don't take that moment.
It's a great segue because I wanted to ask you about imagination, and I want to quote you.
No,
You
gosh.
said that, in essence, I want more of us to dream, create, try, fail, to learn, to live our imaginations in this world. And not only be reactive inside another's creation. And I love that because to me, the body is a portal to creativity and creative response in terms of our relationality and our social action. But it feels to me like our imaginations, our access to our imaginations, is not just the somatic felt experience in the moment, but it's where there's almost, in my experience, there's almost no border between me and the more than human world. And that the sense of imagination in its kind of true fire is something that is whole-bodied, porous, dynamic. And I can't access that when my nervous system is activated, when I'm in fight or flight or freeze. So how does you're saying any kind of movement, a hug, circle helps us access a state of presence. Is that for you, this ability to escape this reactivity of in another person's creation and really return deeply to one's own world and what's available, what can become available to them in terms of creativity? Because it seems like this world needs a lot more creativity and imagination.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know where I said that quote, but it's an interesting one. I'm going to try to make sure that I write that down because.
I'll send it
Okay, thanks. I'm
to
like, what am I saying out here? Yeah, I think one place that I was just considering is that sometimes when we are in our reactivity, our imagination is working in a way, but
Sure.
it's only able to imagine a certain set of circumstances. It's only in a way able to imagine or try to perceive and imagine in that way danger. So I think when we're talking about creativity, it's our imagination being able to run free and make all kinds of connections and imagine things that we haven't seen or outcomes that we don't know. And I agree. I think that's a full bodied and a full body in the sense of, I really include, I think as Dan Siegel that's been saying lately, that the mind is not just a creation of the brain, that the mind is a full bodied creation. And I feel that the mind, the creativity, imagination, perception is. It's full bodied when we think about our bodies as multi-dimensional relational events.
That's awesome. A
I try to
Kronfest,
be in my body.
a lifelong Newport festival.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever your event is, that could be what your body is, but my body is it's an event. It's a happening. Yeah, I think that we're so limited. Our bodies are machines, our bodies are tools. And when we live inside of ourselves that way, it just shuts down so much, of what we can see, perceive, and then create. So, yeah, we are in, I think, serious need of imagination, of innovation that's not about profit. Like, how can I find the thing that you want to spend your money on? But innovation that is just has different motivations, has a motivation to connect, express. That's why we keep seeing the same movies over and over again, or they keep remaking the same movies where we're at the end of the imagination, I think, of this system. But I don't believe we're at the end of imagination. Our imagination inside of these parameters has just been drained. So yeah, I get really excited. You know, I just wrote a book in my first chapter sort of about that and the ability to see around or see through the systems and conditions that we're in, to see underneath, to see between the cracks. That's what I'm most interested in right now.
So where are you seeing the cracks that are most alive with a free imagination, however you define that? Where are the cracks that is enlivening you?
I'm trying to figure out how to give words to what I'm feeling, which is that sometimes the cracks don't feel good. So the cracks, in some ways, to me, are like, what's changing me? What's changing me? Not necessarily what I want to see or what makes me feel hopeful about the world. It makes me feel hopeful about life. There are things that I think moments of solidarity that I've seen in the past few months that make me feel hopeful about life. And I also feel that there's something asking me to change profoundly. And I am afraid of it. But I think, you know, again, it's like when we want to be good, we want to feel good. I like feeling good. Let me
Yeah.
not, I love feeling good. And then sometimes the moment is asking us to break a little, maybe be, let the crack run through us to change and to open and find that we reach for each other in those breakings. So I don't know if it's I feel enlivened, but I feel the power of life when I see that even in the catastrophes that many of us are witnessing now, that we that people are showing up for each other, that they're reaching for each other. There's something there that I'm like, gosh, there's a force that is really unstoppable. And I really honor that. And how do I change in the way that this moment and the next moment are requiring of me? I don't know.
Yeah,
I get scared.
I relate to that because I don't know, as I think I spent a lot of my adult life trying to feel the positivity or the hope in a lot of things. You know, I was the kid who was like recycle and then climate change and gender activism and human rights work and all of those, I think, had a presupposition that there was a particular future that I could contribute to, that, you know, equality, for example, indigenous, non-indigenous, black, white, trans, cishet, you know, all those dimensions of like, what is this perfect, equal future ground? And I feel like what's painful is that humans can be assholes. Like, will we ever outgrow this animalistic nature of power over, you know? And so the pain for me, and I don't know if it's the same for you, is like, as I get older and I have two kids, is that there, it is these cycles of return into these intensities of domination in us, them, and in our time, new levels of intensity that we haven't yet seen. Especially with social media, you know, everybody's watching the horror unfold in Gaza at the same time. Like, you couldn't do that 15 years ago. And so for me, the pain is meeting this horror of what is here. And I'm curious for you, like, what is it that you feel you're being called to change? Or like, what is it that feels so hard in what you're being called into, if you even have a glimpse of what that is, in order to meet this cultural moment with as much, and I'm hearing, generous heart.
I mean, honestly, I don't think I fully know, or it's not articulable yet for me. It's just, noticing that. I was talking to a friend and I said, and I think the world itself is different now than it was, say, 4 months ago. It feels different to me somehow. The way I look at things feels different to me. The things that it sort of stabilized for me is like, this is how I understand the world, feel destabilized in this moment. This is how I understand who I am. And it's all shifting. I don't think it's being like, none of it matters, but I feel that there's adjustments and shifts and yeah, things happening. And I think, as we talked about at the beginning, this gift and curse of social media, I think, are on real display for me because there are things to reconcile between the importance of being able to witness, that witness is critical. Witness is critical. It's important. Things change when you witness. Things change when we do. And when we, there's lots of things that we can do that also change, but witness changes something. To see changes something in us. It changes us. It compels us into action. And there's something about how we witness too that feels like there's something there for us to look at. Because it's been Yeah. Go
Go.
ahead.
I just got excited because what you're saying about witnessing feels like precision. You're looking for the nuance in the experience of witnessing. Like you can witness outrage, you can witness to look good, you can witness to perform allyship but not actually do it. You can witness as kind of a voyeuristic component. So I'm just hearing in you.
Yeah.
Looking for the nuance and the witnessing so that, and maybe that's where I got
Yeah.
excited, interrupted you, but so that we can take right action.
Yeah, I think that's it. In our organization's community, we have a community called the Practice Ground, and we had a session about the witness, and I think this is just a place to explore for all of us now how we witness, what our witnessing does, because I know as an American, our witnessing changes a lot of global conversation, that there's a power just in our looking. And so, how do we take that on and how do we understand? And then, yes, all these other elements that I think social media can warp our witnessing. So, what is our witnessing? What do we want it to be made of? What do we want it to compel us to do? I think those are, yeah, some of the questions I'm in right now.
It sounds like you and I are in a similar experience of something's being changed, but we don't know what we're changing into in this moment. And so, how can witnessing be a portal to freedom in how we're relating and healing across these divides?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, I think it's so that's the thing that alchemizes, because a lot of us wish that a lot of things had never happened. Like, actually, my rage sometimes for me is my frustration that I can't undo the things that have been done. It's infuriating. And that we keep building on top of what has been done is infuriating. You want to tear it all down. And I think there are ways to tear things down. There are lots of ways. And I'm not anti many ways. I'm like, things need to come down. And I think witness is a way things come down too. Because witness. Yes, it does this thing where it's like something in me is changing by witnessing. Because witnessing is like I'm refusing to hold up this wall of separation between us. It doesn't mean that I merge into your experience or pretend like we've had the same experience, but I'm refusing to withhold any ounce of empathy, love, seeing. I'm letting myself be here with you as bare and open as I can be. That does something because if you really witness, you can't leave the witnessing and be the same. You're going to do something different. Something is going to compel you into a different action or right action. So if we really witness, which is what my country at least never wants to do, is take a moment to witness. It haunts. It haunts. And we think violence disappears it, but it just accumulates and it becomes this shadow that haunts. But the witnessing is the alchemizing. It's the changing of our relationship and it's the changing of us and it's the changing then of the future. And I just think, I don't know, there's something really important there for me right now.
As you share that, what comes up for me is the stillness that's required in witnessing. And you said bare and open. And so there is this capacity, and I think this is where the body comes in, is to drop the stories, to be able to witness, being able to drop into the body and let go of the stories, let go of the attachment to who I am, who I've been, in order to listen with a freedom that enables me to attend with deep presence to somebody else's experience and heart. And I think we don't know how to do this well. Think about just workplace conflict, something on such a small scale, we have such a hard time. And then take that to the scale of a nation. In Canada, we're in a process of reconciliation with Indigenous peoples. I mean, it's been years in the making, and there's a lot of critique that we're not doing reconciliation well. And yet, at the same time, we're witnessing ourselves making that decision to reconcile as a country. New immigrants, old settlers like families like mine that are 7 generations Canadian, Irish, and English and French descent. I'm living in the north where Indigenous people, colonization is new. The last residential school closed in 1986. It's recent. And so I'm feeling into this, like that witnessing is a way that we are being changed. Even if we're not doing the doing well,
There's so much, I mean, there's so much crisis. So I understand and also feel the need for doing. There are things that need doing. And I think perhaps some of our stories and our trainings that's unexamined in us have us think that the doing is the only component that matters. And I think the doing is served by what happens in our interiors, what happens in our spirits or our souls or our bodies. What happens there serves our doing in a profound, profound way. And I want us to understand more that it's not stealing time from the doing to be aligned, to be honest, to witness, to feel. You know, if you even want to think about it in those terms, it probably saves time. If I know what I'm doing and why, if I feel it in my cells, what I'm doing, the way I do it is going to be much more powerful, precise, direct, impactful. But when I don't take the time, when part of me is doing this, part of me is acting out this story, part of me is acting out this story, part of me is acting out this other story, you're actually going to be doing 20 things at once.
Yeah. And then making more of a mess in terms of the violence, not necessarily physical, but even the interpersonal violence that comes from
Absolutely.
that, from that.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting. I want to just shift a little bit or relate this into to okay, so leadership now, and part of my work has been about composting outdated modes of leadership to meet this cultural moment. And one of them is maintaining this mind-body split and maintaining good leadership as good strategy and not allowing the emotional or the relational domains to inform wise action. And it's not long ago I sat with a team, and the message was, this isn't a place for emotion. You know, it's sort of like you need to leave the emotion out of the room or bring it in just a little bit to say that we're open to this emotional realm, but essentially leave it out because it's too messy and too hard. And there's so much fear around how to work with it in a skillful way. And so, what would you say to those who are wanting to embody this aligned leadership that's authentic, that's free, that's wise? Where and how can the emotional domain and the body, why, I guess, why is that so essential if we're going to move forward in some new ways?
Well, I've been in this conversation many times, and there's two elements of it to me. One is that emotions are always in the room. You have never been in a room without emotions because no one controls what emotions they feel. The emotions come and go. Emotions are waves, and sometimes those waves last longer than other times. Sometimes a wave comes and we struggle with it in a lot of ways, so it extends. Sometimes a wave comes, we tighten, we do everything we can to resist the wave. But emotions are happening. They're happening as you listen to this podcast, they're happening as you interface with people in your life. You're constantly having emotions, and it's great because emotions tell you what you care about. They tell you what's important to you. Anything that you do, I hope, work, you care about it. Your contribution, you care about it. You're doing it because it stirs something in you. So emotions are there, and they're there to guide us, and they're there to tell us how we feel. That's what they do. They tell us what we care about. Why do the next thing? So any leader has emotions. They just may not be aware of what they are or what's motivating them. So that's one thing that I always say. And I think, I do think it's important to tease out some of the fears that people have. A lot of times, and I'm going to say this carefully, I think many of us do come to all kinds of situations or collaborations in our lives, and we are bringing emotional content that did not originate there. And we're trying to resolve something that is from our past through our current relationship. And I think that is something that comes up that people are afraid of. They're like, this doesn't belong here. And I think it's a both and. Again, it's like the nuance thing. It's not either or. Keep your emotions out or bring everything to every place. But it is to say that in general, we need to understand that we are emotional beings, and that makes our lives beautiful and meaningful. That emotions are happening all the time, and that some of our work, some of our maturation, our growth is to understand what does this originate from? To be curious about ourselves, to have an interior life that helps us process through what we're feeling, and to have the kinds of communities or rituals or that we build things in a way that there are spaces where people can move through what they hold. That's important. So it's all of it for me. When I look at it, it's like all of it. We welcome emotions in the places that we are. We acknowledge that they exist and that they are important. And we want to understand them. And we want places where people can come to understand what is at play inside of them and to develop an ongoing relationship with themselves and their feelings. All of that, I believe, makes us stronger. And it's not just about emotions invading a workplace, but it's about a culture that has made emotions inconvenient and therefore underdeveloped a lot of us in our ability to perceive and understand what it is that we feel.
Goes back to where did we lose it? You know, your comment about where do we lose our sense of our bodies as little people? And I think that is the same for adults, as where do we lose touch with our emotions and the wisdom of them? As you say, they're a portal into really understanding what's important to each of us. So I would love to invite a final question. And I'm curious about, well, maybe two questions. So what somatic practices would you recommend to those listening if emotions feel too much, especially at this cultural moment? Where would you invite people to start or to grow if they have already started to grow some of that capacity to know and be with their interiors?
I think one place to start is a simple grounding, centering, scanning practice. It just has you turn up the volume a little bit on your own sensations to notice that there are sensations happening, that your body is moving, responding, tightening, stretching, adjusting all the time. And if we interpret them, they're little messages, signals to help you understand how you actually feel. But the first thing I think is to just become aware of the orchestra of sensations that are present with you and to sort of build your window of tolerance over time to be with more of those. I think that's one place to start. And you can do that on your own or working with someone who can help you explore that in a way that moves at your pace. And I think practices, I mean, there's so many different practices. A lot of it is about bringing presence to the thing that you're doing. So, having someone place a hand on your back, shoulder, your chest, and allowing yourself to come present to connection, noticing where you pull away or hide, noticing if you numb out when you're connected with or you overextend or try to merge with the person, just noticing what happens in connection and starting to, repattern your nervous system, if you say it that way, or starting to feel into how you can make room for more connection and tolerate more connection in your life. I think that's another one. And honestly, be creative. Do whatever feels good to your body and figure out what that is. I dance. I sing to my child. I hum. I stay present when someone hugs me as much as I can. I roll around and do weird things on the floor that you would not believe. I try to do those things with people. So those are some places to just start. But I would say the journey of being in your body to me is the most remarkable journey that connects me to all life, to all feeling, to life across time. And you don't get to the end of it. It becomes a way that you live this precious life.
Beautiful. Thank you. And so finally, I'm curious about, because this podcast is the tension of emergence, which is an invitation to staying curious and related to these, it's almost like a birth portal, the tension of new challenges, hardships, and recognizing that as we relate to tensions in our own life, that there's surprising new unfoldings, there's new emergence. And so I'm curious what, if this feels helpful to answer it in this way or to phrase it in this way, what tensions are you curious and leaning into at this time in your work? Through you finished a book, you have a child, you're doing deeper work in your community, the Embodiment Institute.
Oh, I have a lot of tensions. So many tensions. I think this tension of the doing and the witnessing, which is also sort of like the traditional way of doing political work, and this thing that I feel like I'm exploring with the Embodiment Institute of creating spaces where we grow and develop and change with each other, how those can support each other and how those are different and necessary spaces of expression. Yeah, I'm in this tension of like, not just like, let's be in community, but why is it so hard? Why do we pull away from each other? What's the fear and how do we get curious and open to each other again? I think that's something that I'm always exploring. And yeah, a million other tensions of having all the things you named, having a child, trying to do work through this organization, write a book. Those are all incredible tensions.
Great. Well, I appreciate just ending on the fact that it's hard, and that even if
Yeah.
you've been as deeply involved in activism and political change and inner development as you, and to hear that it's hard for you, it relaxes me, and it
Yeah.
names something that also feels hard, and also that there's different ways to be deeply engaged in this cultural moment and on behalf of social change and justice and healing. There's many different ways to go about it and to honor those different contributions. It's like sitting and hanging with your kid as they color, and what that, the kind of presence that that requires or could require of a parent. So this from the everyday ordinary all the way to what's happening globally with our nation states. I just appreciate so much your work,
Thank
your
you.
deep integrity, your generosity, and your creativity. You're a beacon of just deep truth and encouragement for me. So with that, just thank you so much for listening to the call for your work.
Thank you, Jennifer. I received that, and I appreciate the beauty of the questions you posed here today. They'll be sitting with me.
No, thank you.
So here's the essence of what I'm taking from our conversation. What if we understood our bodies not as an object, not as an object to be filled up, controlled, objectified, but more like an event, as a ritualized unfolding of remembering who we truly are, as a catalyst for being present to whatever needs to be felt, expressed in either ourselves or one another, that our bodies can become a movement towards collective healing. Prentice's invocation that bodies are made to feel, witness, and heal alongside each other is so simple, but not easy. Prentice reminds us that our bodies hold tremendous nuance, and when we can return to our bodies and ground ourselves, we're able to contact it, to feel more and hold more. Because this feeling helps us be precise, helps us avoid binaries and compartmentalization. We avoid mimicking and saying what we consider to be the right thing. Instead, we avoid getting trapped in assumptions about what's right or wrong. With nuance, we can discern right action. And this feels like such a departure from the realm of strategy, from the realm of using our minds and our will to figure out what should be next. It's far from dissociating from our emotions and the wisdom of what's unfolding within us. It means that our bodies hold a wisdom that shouldn't be ignored, but more importantly, reveal the possibility what can come from when we engage and weave it in. If you'd like to learn more about Prentice's work, their new book, What It Takes to Heal, which is available June 4th, 2024, their writing and courses, you can find all the resources and links from this episode in the show notes. If you know someone who'd appreciate this conversation, please share it with them. We're weaving a wholehearted web on this show based on kinship, not kingship, at the speed of one heart-opening conversation at a time. And if you'd like to stay in touch with me, Jennifer, and receive practices, radical encouragement, and offerings to support your creative emergence as you lead, come sign up for my emails at www.sparkcoaching.ca/evolve-subscribe. And hey, before we close this first episode of season three, I want to let you know that after each one of these deeper dives, I'll be offering a bonus practice episode on Fridays. These are micro, they're brief, less than 5 minutes, and are designed to help you apply what you've learned alongside my guests in the field of your own life. By the end of this season, my hope is that you'll have a bundle of new practices to play and experiment with. Some will spark curiosity, others might drive you a little crazy, but I hope that they mostly nourish you deeply. You can download and save them, share your favorites, and return to them again and again as the seasons change. That's all for now, my friend. Be sure to tune in this Friday for your first practice. I'm Jennifer England. Thanks for listening.